Okay, I believe we left off on page 24. We talked about the creeds already?
Mm-hmm.
Talked about the creeds. So we're still talking on New Testament reliability. We should be able to wrap this up and then move right into evidence for the resurrection. So with the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts, we talked about the manuscript evidence that the New Testament has more evidence, manuscript evidence for it than for any other ancient writing. We talked about the testimony of the apostolic fathers, ancient non-Christian writers, and then the ancient creeds found in the New Testament, which date, you know, obviously earlier than Paul's writings, which were the 50s and 60s A.D., but some of them go as far back as 33 to 37 A.D. And, here we're talking about data that is agreed upon by the vast majority of New Testament scholars today. So now, when you talk about the Jesus Seminar, they are just so radical that, they just refuse to acknowledge what the latest scholarship has produced. Now, as far as the New Testament reliability being confirmed by experts, rather than spend a real lot of time on that, what I'm going to do is just read from pages 108 and 109 of my book, No Other Gods, A Defense of Biblical Christianity, because there I just sum up the conclusions of at least some of these guys that we have listed. And I titled this section The Opinions of the Experts. The testimonies of some of the world's leading experts can be called upon to further verify the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament manuscripts. Dr. John A.T. Robinson, one of England's leading New Testament critics, came to the conclusion that the entire New Testament was written before the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. That's even more radical in my views, because I believe Revelation and 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John and the Gospel, quite possibly the Gospel of John. I'm open to the possibility of the Gospel of John being written before 70 A.D. because of one passage in John, but which would, basically, that would just, if that could be proven, that would just revolutionize New Testament criticism today, because even conservative scholars assume that John was written at the earliest 85 A.D. And but John A.T. Robinson, by the way, was a skeptic. I believe it was the Shroud of Turin that started moving him in the direction of more traditional Christianity, and then he began to relook at the, because he wrote like Honest to God, where he's basically rejecting traditional Christianity, and then next thing he writes a book redating the New Testament and pushes the whole New Testament before 70 A.D. Sir William Ramsay was one of the world's greatest archaeologists. His thorough investigation into Luke's Book of Acts led him to the conclusion that Acts was a mid-first century document that was historically reliable. He went big time into the details. In fact, he set out to disprove them, to think that, you know, I'm this great archaeologist and I can do all these digs and I can show that this, you know, I've heard this book isn't reliable and I'm the guy to prove it. And the more dirt he overturned, the more Luke came out looking good. William F. Albright is one of the world's foremost biblical archaeologists. He states that there is no evidential basis for dating any New Testament book after 80 A.D. When both Albright and Robinson say that no book's been written after either 70 or 80 A.D., one thing that does show us is that, you know, maybe the books that we date later, you know, maybe we ought to maybe quite possibly suspend judgment, because something's up with these guys when guys of this caliber. I mean, these guys are like, you know, every one of these guys that I mentioned is like in the top, was in the, during his life, was in the top five in their field in the world. Sir Frederick Kenyon was one of the world's leading experts on ancient manuscripts. His research led him to conclude that the New Testament is essentially the same as when it was originally written. Miller Burroughs, the great archaeologist from Yale, stated that there is no doubt that archaeological research has strengthened confidence in the historical reliability of the Bible. Barrows also stated that the skepticism of liberal scholars is based on their prejudice against the supernatural rather than on the evidence itself. F.F. Bruce, New Testament scholar from Manchester University in England, stated that if the New Testament writings had been secular works, no scholar would question their authenticity. Bruce believes that the evidence for the New Testament outweighs the evidence for many classical works which have never been doubted. Bruce Metzger is a famous textual critic from Princeton. He has stated that the New Testament has more evidence in its favor than any other writings from ancient Greek or Latin literature. It is clear that the evidence favors the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament. Scholars who do not allow their bias against the supernatural to influence their conclusions have recognized this fact. Scholars who reject the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts do so because they choose to go against the overwhelming evidence. However, such a rejection is not true scholarship. It is an a priori assumption. And so basically, there's a lot. I just received a magazine. It's a magazine for people in the public about this guy who's claiming that the Old Testament has been refuted through archaeology. And the only problem with that view is the world's leading archaeologist. There probably isn't any one of the world's leading archaeologists that would say something that bold. For one reason, archaeology very rarely disproves anything. I mean, when an archaeologist thinks that Jericho was in a certain ancient Jericho was in a certain area, and then he starts digging, they're almost always open to the possibility that they might be digging in the wrong place to begin with. Okay. That's just, it goes with the turf, for lack of a better word, but it goes with the turf of archaeology and ancient digs. So it actually serves more for the purpose of confirming something and just in extreme cases, like with Mormonism, the Book of Mormon makes so many extravagant claims for North America, with just huge civilizations in certain areas in ancient times. And, you know, without any archaeological evidence whatsoever, dig after dig still uncovers nothing, and you have, you know, evidence of tribal peoples, the Native Americans, but you don't have any evidence of an advanced civilization. So that's an example when archaeology can disprove something. But when you're going in the land of Palestine, where there were civilization after civilization after civilization after civilization, then it's a little tougher to straight out disprove something, and the decisions are usually made in a much more tentative manner. But whatever the case, there's an excellent quote, and that deals with the Old Testament, though, but there's an excellent quote in by Gleason Archer's work, Survey of Old Testament Introduction, where basically, I can't even remember who he was talking about, but he basically quotes from a great archaeologist, and probably one of the guys that I just mentioned earlier, who says that there have been numerous archaeological excavations that have proven some factor of the Bible, the Old Testament, to be historical, or in fact of the Bible to be historical, but there has never been an archaeological find that has in an undisputed manner refuted any aspect of the Bible. That's a pretty important quote, because what he's saying is that for thousands of years men have dug, and yet for thousands of years of digging, we've yet to find anything to disprove any historical claim in the scriptures, but we have found multitudes of things to confirm the data that is there. Now, if that particular archaeologist had been a fire-breathing atheist, then he could handle the evidence in a more dishonorable way and act like if... See, there are some scientists, whether they be archaeologists or there, maybe even New Testament critics, who are so biased against the Bible that if the Bible mentions a civilization like the Hittites, and we never, archaeologists never found evidence of the Hittites, then therefore the Hittites don't exist. Well, they never found anything to disprove the existence of the Hittites. They just, at one time, didn't have any evidence of them. Of course, that was before the mid-19th century and the early 20th century, because now not only do we... They found evidence of the existence of the Hittites. And so they thought, okay, well, they exist, but they weren't this advanced civilization around 2000 B.C., around the time of Abraham. But then at least they found their... The treaty between them and the Hittites and the king, and how advanced their laws were, and push comes to shove, we find more and more evidence of the advanced stage of their civilization that far back. And now the Hittites are not even brought up by skeptics in conversations because the evidence is... has so overwhelmingly confirmed the authenticity of the Bible, the accuracy of the Bible. So, but whatever the case, you're always going to get, this is sad too, because sometimes it will be thrown out on college campuses, but you're always going to get some guy who maybe is a good journalist or a good writer, and he's a fire-breathing atheist, who is going to write this recent article. You know, he's going to write this article, it's going to be hot off the presses, and everybody's going to think that he disproved Christianity, and they don't realize he's read two books on the subject, and they're both over 100 years old as far as the research is involved. So what needs to be done is, you know, talk to the leading archaeologists, and then even there you've got to try to figure out, is this guy claiming that his finds are either proving or disproving more than really is, you know, more than we're able to do. Additional evidences, I think I mentioned these already, but let me just run through them real quick. We know that Matthew wrote his gospel based on the testimony of Papias, and he stated that Matthew originally wrote it in Hebrew, and then translated it to Greek as he went to preach the gospel to the Gentiles, which was probably about 42 to 44 A.D. when the apostles were being persecuted, so they fled from the Palestine area. I remember on Sundays we're preaching about Acts. You were in Acts chapter 9, and from Acts chapter 6, 7, and 8, we learned that there was persecution, and it was probably, you know, the apostles didn't even have to leave, yet the church was being persecuted. But it was all coming from the synagogue of the freedmen, who were Hellenistic Jewish converts to Christianity. So that early stage of persecution, that is weird, but the apostles, the leaders of the early church, who had been arrested several times by the Sanhedrin already, were not on the top 10 wanted list. And probably the top 7 guys wanted were Stephen, Philip, and the other 5 deacons. And, whatever the case, eventually the apostles had to flee, and they were marked out. That's when Peter was imprisoned, and James was imprisoned. James, the brother of John, and then James was put to death. He was beheaded by King Herod. And at that point, it wasn't safe for the apostles anymore, so the apostles fled. And it was at that point that James became the leader in the early church. I disagree with those who act like James, the half-brother of Jesus, was the leader of the early church before Peter left. I think it's pretty much it was Peter and the other apostles had to leave before he was the guy with the most authority that was there. Certainly he was a big gun in the history of the church, no doubt about it. And he was right up there on the same level as the apostles. When, you know, Peter talked about James and Peter and John, the pillars of the church. But it just seems to me that wherever Peter went, he led, with one possible exception, and that's it. Both he and Paul were there. They were both considered the big goonies. But the names don't get any bigger than Peter and Paul, and I don't think I have to go. I don't think I have to produce a big in-depth article argument other than saying if somebody was as big on the same level as Peter and Paul in the early church, then the book of Acts would be broken down into Peter, Paul, and the other guy. But since you could just break it down into it talks about Peter and his ministry and Paul and his ministry, those are pretty much the big guns right there. But Paul does make it clear when Peter stepped out of line, he was the first to confront him. And you know, that really hits at the heart of the Roman Catholic view of infallibility. So, but it's my view that Matthew, as the tax collector, would probably been the stenographer who, if I were Jesus, I probably would have picked Matthew to take notes when I taught. And so his earliest gospel may have been, there may have been very few of events listed and just some of the key sermons of Jesus. But then when he translated it into Greek, he probably had to add the events, because once you get outside of Palestine, there's going to be a lot of people who just aren't familiar with the story of Jesus' life. And nowadays, it is believed that Mark wrote his gospel first, and this is all done from the internal research of critics, most of whom are liberal critics and are not Christians, but the church historically from the very beginning has said Matthew's gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that was the order they were written in, period. And I don't see any reason why we should reject that. Now, there are very few, even among conservative scholars, they put Mark first. There are very few that are willing, that are bold enough to say what I'm saying, that's that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the proper order. John Wenham, out of Great Britain, he wrote a book redating the Gospels, redating the Synoptic Gospels or whatever. And he comes the closest to me. There's two Roman Catholic scholars who come real close to me as well in the datings. But he dates Matthew's to the 30s A.D., Wenham, and Mark's gospel to 44 A.D. after Peter left Rome. That's what Papias tells us. And then Luke to the late 50s A.D. And he doesn't talk much about John. That's not his focus there. But those are the kinds of dates I think the conservatives need to look at. Because the only reason why conservatives say Mark was written about 67 A.D. and some conservatives say Matthew was written about 80 A.D. and, you know, the only reason why they're saying that kind of weird stuff is because a liberal liberal scholarship dates the books as late as you possibly can without embarrassing yourself. I don't see any reason why we should do that. And conservative scholars can't date Luke that late because it's these Acts is its sequel, so let's forget this pseudo scholarship and really deal with the evidence. And I think if we do that, the dates will be pushed back. Matthew was quoted very, very early by early church fathers, as was Mark. We already said Mark's gospel. He actually got it from Peter. Luke and Acts, we talked about that a little, but Acts was Luke's sequel, both addressed to Theophilus, and Paul's death is not recorded in Acts. It just leaves us hanging at about 61 A.D., so Acts was probably written about 61 A.D., and Luke was probably written a few years earlier, so some would date Luke at about 56 A.D., but Luke and Acts are both quoted early. John's gospel is quoted or paraphrased by Ignatius, Polycarp, and Papias. This is one reason why we might need to take a closer look. There's two main reasons why we might need to take a closer look. Actually, three main reasons why we may need to take a closer look at John's Gospel, about quite possibly dating it before the destruction of the temple. One is, there's a passage, I believe, in John chapter 5 that seems to imply that the temple is still standing. Two, the reason why it's dated so late is because the theology is so developed. Yet, that could be explained for two reasons. One, John was the apostle that was the closest to Jesus. And I really think you can make a strong case that either John wrote it, or somebody that he gave the gospel to, because it's his gospel, because there's absolutely no reason to leave out John's name in that gospel. John never mentions his name once. How could you not mention one of the three biggest apostles, Peter, and James and John, the two sons of Zebedee? Everybody's mentioned but John by name. He's just referred to as the disciple whom Jesus loved. The only way to explain that is the humility of the author, if the author was in fact John himself. There's certain facts that you can see that only John would know. In the scripture of the blood and the water of coming out of Christ's side, only John was there. I do think, I wouldn't be surprised if the other apostles saw the crucifixion from a distance, you know, from a safe distance, but John was right there, and
the Mary told me.
What's that? I think John comes right out and says that he was the one who, well, the disciple whom Jesus loved. He talks about himself in the third person. That's why some objected John as John. But I think if you're going to talk about the third person, then there's no reason why you would leave out his name. And you say, well, this is what John said. But it seemed to me like he had so much humility that he just figured, I'll refer to myself as the disciple whom Jesus loved and never mention my name. And you could say, well, maybe somebody else wanted to refer to him as the disciple whom Jesus loved. Yeah, but then, why not mention his name so everybody knows exactly who you're talking about? And you get in John 19, and when Jesus is being crucified there, one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out of it. It's verse 34. And then verse 35 says, and he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, so that you may believe. And over again, he talks that way. And, you know, he ends up the whole gospel with, this is the disciple, verses 20 to 25. You tell me who he's talking about here. This is the last six verses of John's Gospel, chapter 21, verses 20 to 25. Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved. Well, that was obviously John. Who also had leaned on his breast at the supper, and said, so Peter said, this Lord, John had said, his Lord, who is the one who betrays you? And then Jesus gave him the answer. Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about this man? Because Jesus just predicted how Peter's going to die. So then Peter's, one last time, he's going to frustrate Jesus. Peter's the guy, he probably holds the record for the most guy to frustrate God incarnate, you know. But verse 22, Jesus said to him, if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me. And so he's like saying, Peter, look, just follow me. I just told you you're going to be killed for the faith. It's none of your business what I'm going to do with John. What if I want him to remain alive till I return? It's none of your business. Now just, I'm trying to tell you, you're going to die for the faith. Get serious, follow me. You got to leave these guys. You know, he's telling me, feed his sheep and all. And then it says, he says that, you know, but he said, you know, it's my business. If I want him to remain alive till I come back, that's my business. So verse 23, then this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? So he's basically saying, look, this doesn't mean that John's going to be alive when Jesus returns and all. So then he says, this is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. So there's one of two things there. Either this is John talking about himself in the third person, or this is a guy who's saying these were the things that John said, and he says right there, and wrote. So this is his gospel, and I just wrote it down in the final form. But whatever way you look at it, it's John. And then verse 25, and there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. Amen. And so one reason why maybe we need to take another look is that John is obviously the ultimate author of this other than God, you know, with the dual authorship. Number two, yes, it has a very developed theology, but John knew Jesus intimately. That's one thing. Number two, if the other Gospels, if we push those dates earlier, at least if we push Matthew and Mark to before 44 A.D., and if we see that Luke, written in 56 A.D., the main emphasis, according to himself, the main issue was the historical chronology of Jesus' public ministry and not the theology of it. If John's Gospel ended up being written about 67, 68 A.D., which I do not favor that position at this point, but if he did, from 44 to 68 A.D., you have ample time for theological reflection, especially since Paul, who was trained face-to-face by Jesus, developed some of the doctrines on the deity of Christ. You know, God inspired him to do so. So, you have some good reasons there. But the third reason is John was quoted or paraphrased, and this is important, earlier than anybody else. Ignatius, Polycarp, and Papias. Now, granted, it was probably because these guys were his pupils, but, I mean, doesn't that count as some evidence that maybe this book was earlier than we think? The fact that by 107 A.D., he's already being quoted by Ignatius. Okay? So, I mean, you don't have to bypass the Apostolic Fathers to find him quoted and go to the next generation. He's already being quoted by guys, you know, he's already being quoted by Ignatius probably 7 to 15 years after John's death. So, I don't know. We need to take a closer look at that. And, it's really, some will date. Some scholars were willing to do their original thinking rather than just jump on the bandwagon with the bulk of New Testament scholarship, which of course the high percentage of them are not believers. But those evangelicals who were willing to do, and sometimes even non-evangelicals, their own study, usually arrived at the conclusion that even if John was written before 70 A.D., first, second, and third John and Revelation were probably written 85 to 95 A.D. Now, having said that, you do get some scholars, like the ones that we read, that say, the whole New Testament was completed before 70 A.D. or 80 A.D. So, it's a tough one to quote. Papias, and his quote, there's two ways of looking at what he says. He talks about the Apostle John and he talks about the presbyter or the elder John. However, some have argued, like F.F. Bruce, that he's not talking about two different guys. He's talking about two different groups, but not two different guys. That basically, we see the apostles and then, boom, the apostolic fathers. But Papias, who's an apostolic father, is saying there's a group in between called the elders. Basically, the elders appointed by the apostles, and it was basically appointed by the apostles while the apostles were still, you know, kind of in their prime. Whereas the apostolic fathers were appointed by the apostles when the apostles knew they were on the way out. Okay, and so he says, "Hey, look," Pappy is saying, "Look, man, what I'm saying is authoritative, okay? Because I don't settle disputes about the scriptures by studying the scriptures. I settle those disputes by talking to the authors. So I talked to that first group, the apostles," and he lists a few of them by name, John included. And then he said, "And then I talked to the group of guys, the elders, who are still with us to this day," or whatever, and he mentions, like, you know, I don't even think he says they're still with us to this day, but I talked to the elders, and Ariston or somebody, some name similar, and then he mentions the elder John. But it's possible that the elder John is John the Apostle, but it's kind of like the day of the apostles are gone, and now it's the day of the elders, and the lead elder is the Apostle John. But if it's either that, or the elder John was the Apostle John's number one student and recorded 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and possibly Revelation, although the evidence... See, you get guys right after Papias, and they're saying that John the Apostle wrote the Gospel of John and Revelation, and some may even lean in the direction of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. And the argument goes, okay, they were confused. They confused John the Apostle with John the Elder. Maybe not. Maybe they understood better what Papias was saying than we do, and knew that it was just a different age, an age of elders. But whatever the case, real early on after Papias, they were equating the author of the Gospel of John and Revelation with the Apostle John. And 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, there's like a lot of silence about it. That's real early on, which is expected. I mean, smaller letters, you can't expect them every time a guy writes a letter to quote from every book that he reads is scriptural. So, Paul's letters, except for the general epistles, they're widely accepted. And so very rarely do you even find a New Testament critic. I mean, even Michael Martin acknowledges that Paul wrote 1 Corinthians about 54 A.D. So he has to do some really fancy dancing to try to claim that creed that Paul came up with there, why it wasn't accurate. Okay, and his case against Christianity is where you'll see his views there. And Habermas has a chapter devoted to refuting him in the historical Jesus. The reason why Paul's general epistles aren't widely accepted, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, is because it's thought that the church organization is just simply too complex and too well designed to be that early in church history, to be before 67 AD, which is the latest date that Paul could have died. The problem is, that's an outdated argument, because we now know that the organizational structure that Paul laid out wasn't much different than the organizational structure of the Jewish synagogues of that day. So, I mean, what's the problem here? You know, I mean, it's just like the old argument that Moses couldn't have written the first five books of the Bible because writing wasn't invented back then. And now we know writing goes back at least 1,500 years before Moses lived. So, I mean, even that common people, many of them knew how to write just for business transactions 1,500 years before Moses. And then the book of Hebrews, just from the internal evidence for the book of Hebrews being written before 70 A.D., is so overwhelming that anyone who rejects it, you know, just get a life. That's I mean, because here the guy's arguing that to his readers, Jewish people who profess faith in Christ, who are now thinking of leaving Christianity and returning to Judaism, his whole argument is, look, Jesus offered his body as a sacrifice once and for all. He's now seated at the Father's right hand. It means that sacrifice has worked. He has done what was needed to do to save us. On the other hand, the temple priests are still standing right now, and they're still offering sacrifices day after day after day, which means their work is never done. So why would you go back to that when obviously the bloodshed of animals doesn't take away sins, or these guys would be seated now because it would have worked? But it didn't accomplish that, so they're still standing. It's still, now, why in the world use that argument if they're not still standing? If they're not still offering sacrifices? I mean, his argument, I mean, his opponents would just say, well, you're a nut, whoever you are, whether the author of Hebrews is Apollos or Barnabas or somebody else. They would say, well, you're a nut. You're not still standing. The temple's been destroyed. If the temple was destroyed, his argument would be this. This is like one of the strongest arguments from silence. Most arguments from silence stink, you know. Well, he didn't believe it because he didn't say it. Okay? It's like Paul never mentioned the virgin birth, therefore he never heard of it and didn't believe it. Is it a coincidence that he said Jesus was born of a woman? You know, I mean, why say that? You know, I mean, it's pretty obvious. Every man is born of a woman, but it's also the agency of a man. Why not just say he was born of Joseph and Mary? But he didn't even mention the Father. So, right there is just like, you know, a lucky coincidence? I don't know. But whatever the case, but this is a strong argument from silence, because his argument would be thus, if the temple had been destroyed. Look, why trust in the temple in Old Testament Judaism and the temple sacrifices, when if God meant that to last forever and ever, if God didn't wanted the temple sacrifice to be more than temporary, then why did God just allow the Romans to lambast the temple and destroy it? So the destruction of the temple would have been the strongest argument against the temple sacrifices, against the lasting, what's the word I'm looking for? Against the lasting, not sufficiency, but the, against the lasting effect of the animal sacrifices. If he's going to argue against that, just say, hey, the temple's been demolished, so obviously it wasn't God's eternal plan to have these animal sacrifices on and on and on.
Well, the temple was destroyed before, and the animal sacrifices were still in effect back then.
Actually, no. They could do the Passover without the temple, but that was pretty much about it. I mean, whenever the temple was destroyed, the animal sacrifices ceased, and in fact, in the Babylonian captivity, since the Solomon's temple had been destroyed, that's when they started doing the synagogue thing.
But it was built back though. But still, it was still animal sacrifices. No Messiah had come yet.
Yeah, but in other words, he could have used as another argument, if he wanted to, no animal sacrifices between 586 BC and 536 BC. Because if animal sacrifices are the way sins are forgiven, you got a whole 70. Actually, you go to 606 BC, but you've got 70 years Babylonian captivity, no animal sacrifices. So that'd be another, just another argument against animal sacrifices taking away sins. Because I mean, what about that whole generation? No animal sacrifices to be offered in accordance with God's Old Testament commands to take away sins. So it's a basic question I ask Orthodox Jews: does the bloodshed of animals take away sins? And very rarely will you find one that will say yes. But if they said yes, then you say, well, what do you do now? You don't have a temple standing, you know. And but most would admit what the author of Hebrews says, the bloodshed of animals doesn't take away sins. But then if it doesn't, why did God order the slaughter of all these innocent animals throughout history? You think he was trying to hint at something? You know, and there usually the Orthodox Jew would get upset because it's pretty obvious.
They didn't need a temple though. Couldn't they just build an altar and sacrifice? Because wasn't the temple just something maybe you wanted to do for, just to honor God, since God was living in a tent?
Yeah, but see, the reason why God was living in a tent was he was in the tabernacle. It was, even though the tabernacle was a portable temple, it was still the only temple. So, and once they built a stationary temple, that was it. And so for the temple to be destroyed, it would have to be rebuilt in the same place. And all I'm getting at is the author of Hebrews, he's arguing against returning to Judaism. And instead of arguing, well, look, there's no temple, so why return to Judaism? The temple's been destroyed. Obviously, the temple only served a temporary purpose. But instead he didn't argue that way. He argued, look, you're my opponents and I'm trying to win a debate with you, and the Old Testament priests are still standing and still offering sacrifices, which shows that these animal sacrifices don't take away sins. Otherwise the work would have been completed by now. And so basically his whole argument presupposes, for there to be any weight to his argument, the temple had to be standing. If it wasn't standing, they would have said, you fool, the temple's been demolished. Priests are not still offering sacrifices. So his whole argument, and there's actually a principle, Jesus Under Fire, William Lane Craig gives the, is it enemy attestation or something? There's a title of it where it makes it one of the toughest premises to refute, because you're giving too much ammunition to your enemy if this certain state of affairs is not in fact there. So basically, if you're debating, when Paul's debating the Corinthians, if the 500 people, the 500 witnesses weren't, if most of them weren't alive, him stating that they were is just begging his opponents to refute him. And so nobody, you know, there's no New Testament scholar that I know of that's going to say, okay, yeah, Paul was lying there. Okay, it's just too much at stake. His apostolic authority, no. It's the same way there. The guy says the Old Testament priests are still standing and still offering the sacrifices. He's saying this to his opponents, you know, not to his friends. So they're not going to overlook a big blunder like that if the guys are not still standing in the temple and offering the sacrifices. So, but basically you've got Hebrews, you know, pretty much had to be written before 70 AD. Otherwise his argument makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Now what we're going to be talking about here is evidence for Jesus' resurrection. All we have really argued for at this point, and I think that's where we ran into a big hoopla and misunderstanding, and we were talking apples and oranges. All we've really dealt with about historical reliability has nothing to do, really. I mean, there's certain aspects of it that, oh yeah, the archaeology proved this happened, and this seems to have really occurred. But for the most part, all we've tried to establish is that the New Testament is not a collection of legends. That these are accounts from either eyewitnesses or people who knew eyewitnesses. Now we're going to try to get into the area of, well, is what they said true? And so we deal with the issue of Christ's resurrection. I mean, if Christ's resurrection is true, if you can acknowledge, okay, Jesus did rise from the dead, that's a historical fact, then why would you have a problem with any other miracles that he performed? I mean, that's the toughest thing to pull off would be his resurrection from the dead. And just for starters, to see it in all four Gospels,